We are ready to start Acts chapter 6, finish out that last verse, verse 15, and then move into Acts chapter 7. If you remember from Acts chapter 7, we have a lot of history. Stephen goes back, and as he's making his defense before the Sanhedrin, he recites a lot of Old Testament events. This is a complicated chapter to teach, and there are a couple of ways to do it. You could highlight everything that's in the chapter, or you could skip the information, or you could try to slug your way through all those Old Testament events. I don't want to slug my way through all the Old Testament events because this is more a class about Acts and Christianity versus the Old Testament history. So here's kind of what the plan is. One of the old teachings, for those who have been instructed in how to preach was tell them what you're going to tell them, tell them, tell them again. So I don't know that I exactly do that as far as how I try to preach, but that's sort of how we're going to do Acts chapter 7. I'm going to tell you what it's about. I already did that. And then we're going to give you an outline of what is in there, and then I'm actually going to read it and try to tie all that together. So I think that's probably going to be the easiest way to do that, and then we don't get bogged down with a lot of things that are not really relevant to the book of Acts. So that's going to be the plan. But we do want to finish up with Acts 6 and verse 15, see if there's some things that you want to add or ask about that. Then we'll, as I say, get into Acts chapter 7 and try to begin sorting that out. Last verse in Acts 6. And all that sat in the council, fastening their eyes on him, saw his face as it had been the face of an angel. Now, as you back up a little bit, in Acts chapter 6, verses 13 and 14, you have some accusations made against Stephen. Let's go back there. What were the accusations made against him? These are important as far as the context. What did they say against him? Blasphemy. All right, you're guilty of blasphemy, and for the Jews, that was a big problem. What else did they say? They were the false witnesses that were suborned. They were brought in to lie. And what else did they say? All right, he's not ceasing to talk about the holy place and the law. And then they said in verse 14, we've heard him say about this Jesus of Nazareth, he's going to do what to this place? The temple, he's going to destroy it. And when it comes to the customs which Moses had delivered, what's he going to do? Change those customs. If nothing else had been said, what about the customs that had been delivered by Moses? This is how you worship God. If you are a Jew and you hear of somebody who comes along and says, we're going to change your way of religion, I mean, that's going to be upsetting. People are upset when they get some news that's going to significantly affect their life, and that is certainly true here. So now as you have this taking place, in verse 15, have all the council, that would be the Sanhedrin, they're looking at him, they fasten their eyes on him, and that's an interesting word. As you look at the King James translation, it says, looking steadfastly. If you were to look at Luke chapter 4 and verse 20, you'd find there, and this is not the only time, but that's another passage where you have this same word being used. You have the eyes being glued on somebody. They're not going to miss a detail. They're looking for everything that they can get as far as what's taking place in a person's life or looking at a person's face. And Alinsky, one commentator, said that people were struck but not moved, and that is a pretty good description of it. As they're looking at him, and as they're considering these changes that he's talking about, you have the face of an angel. That is, I think, a way of saying that it was radiant. Now, here's a point where some people say we have a different idea, and I don't know that we can conclusively prove one way or the other. Do you think that this was a natural phenomena, or do you think it was a miracle? Well, let's just take a quick show of hands. Anybody think it was a natural phenomena? Zero? Wow. Well, I guess the rest would either not... Huh? You think it was a natural phenomena?
No.
Oh, okay. Maybe they're hitting a bunch of electricity. Yeah, they might glow for a minute, but yeah, they didn't have electricity back then.
You can get that impression, especially early in the morning, like today, if somebody has their back to the sun.
Okay, yeah, you might see that. Aside from that, as far as a glow, do you see that with people sometimes? They just glow. I mean, not radiate in the sense that you have something divine, but people glow. People ever sort of glow?
When they're pregnant.
All right, I think that's the first, and maybe that's the most obvious. You see that glow, and a person will say you're glowing, and it doesn't mean that they're shining like the sun, but it does mean that they have that somewhat special look about them. Any other times where you see a quote-unquote glow?
When they're
All right, I think there's a significant event. A person gets a new job and they're elated at that. They've been looking for a long time and they just seem to shine a little bit. I finally got a job. I finally got a new car. There's been a marriage proposal in my life. So you see those significant events in the person. We say he lit up. So we do recognize on some level that that can take place. But here, and again, I can't prove this conclusively, but here I'm inclined to think that this was a supernatural glow in part for this reason. Let's go back to the book of Exodus for a second. Exodus 34, verses 29 and 35. Moses is coming down from Sinai. Now remember what we've just looked at as far as verses 13 and 14 in Acts chapter 6. Who are we talking about? Stephen, and one of the charges was he's coming and he's trying to undo all the stuff that Moses brought us. All right? That's just before you get to this glow, this radiance. Exodus 34, who's got it? And wants to start with verse 29.
When Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, as he came down from the mountain, Moses did not show that the skin of his face shone because he had been talking with God.
Okay, and then 35 as well, if you would. 34, 35. Okay, so you have this radiance, this supernatural glowing from Moses. I don't see that it's much of a jump from Exodus 34 to what we have in Acts chapter 7. Because, again, you're talking about Moses, and are you really changing the law? You must be some kind of apostate. It makes perfect sense for me for God to have given him that sign to say, look, he is connected to Moses, and this is the natural progression. We had Moses for a while, now we're coming to Christ and the gospel. So to me, I'm really inclined to favor that this was a supernatural act. The people who would be on the other side of the fence would sometimes argue, well, what does the face of an angel look like? That's what you were thinking, huh?
Yeah, how do they know?
Yeah, how do they know? Well, there were some angels that showed up in the first century, and you would think that an angel would be bright and glorious, and that might just be something that they suspected. But anyway, like I say, I can't prove that with 100% certainty, but those are basically the two arguments that you have there. Any other thoughts before we pick up with Acts 7:1? Stan?
In verses 13 and 14, these men are listening to Stephen. I can just envision them sort of sitting on the edge of their seats, leaning forward, concentrating on what he's saying, and then he stops. Well, he has told them so much that's different from what they're normally thinking that it's almost as if you could see them lean back in their seats, thinking about what it was he said the whole time watching him. And then to have something like suddenly his face begins to glow as if he were an angel, that had to have been a real wow factor.
Yeah, you've got 70 guys who are not the village idiots. I mean, these fellows should have been very, very sharp, very, very wise. They should have been exposed to a wide range of experiences. And to see this, it's one more sign. And like I say, they surely were familiar with what had happened with Moses. I mean, this was not stuff that was buried there in the Old Testament. Back there in Exodus, one of the first five books of the Bible, if you had anybody on there that didn't accept the first any of the books past the first five. So yes, they should have made a clear connection. But just like the other apostles did signs and they were rejected, Jesus too, this is one more that's thrown out the window. Okay. Let's take a look at Acts 7:1. And the high priest said, are these things so? Now, isn't that interesting? This kind of ties in with what Stan was saying just a minute ago. You've got this preacher. He's ready to make the charges stick against these people. He's been faulted for many things. We looked at that in verses 13 and 14. And the high priest just stands up. He's not asking what? Why is your face glowing? Assuming, again, that this is supernatural. But are these charges true? The people have said various things against you, and are these things so? So he completely ignored a sign from God, just as we said. The apostles had that same problem. Jesus had that same problem. And today, you still have that same issue taking place. Now, as you look at the rest of the chapter, and again, you've probably read through this at various times. Maybe recently, you have a speech that's made by Stephen. It is the longest speech that you have in the book of Acts. I mean, if you kind of look ahead a little bit, you've got how many? 60 verses in this chapter. So it is a fairly long chapter. And yet, as he goes through all this, you know that Stephen died and he's put to death in a very mean way. You have in about 20 verses, about 700 years, or several hundred years, about 700 of Hebrew history. And as you look at the sections that are divided up, you can put it into five different points or five different sections. He speaks about Abraham. That's going to be in verses 2 through 8. We'll read that in a little bit. And then after he talks about Abraham, he's going to turn to Joseph and talks about Joseph's sojourn in verses 9 through 16. Then he's going to turn to Moses. That's going to be in verses 17 to 43. And then after he talks about Moses, he's going to talk about the building of the tabernacle and the time of Joshua. That's going to be in 44 to 46. And then finally, he's going to talk about the reigns of David and Solomon in verses 47 through 50. One source gave this breakdown, which I really like. He said, Abraham was the forerunner, Joseph was the preserver, Moses was the deliverer, David and Solomon were the temple builders, and the prophets were the nation's teachers. So he lays this out, again, from our perspective, it's fairly lengthy, but as you start looking at how many years of Hebrew history are involved, he really sums things up in a very nice way, and I think that helps you understand just how effective inspiration can be when trying to communicate some things. Before I go back and try to read through all that, I'll give you this information as well. One source broke down the chapter in this way. He said, Stephen reviewed the history of Israel and the contributions made by their revered leaders, Abraham, Joseph, Moses, Joshua, David, and Solomon. But this address was more than a recital of familiar facts. It was also a refutation of their indictments against Stephen and a revelation of their own natural sins. Stephen proved from their own scriptures that the Jewish nation was guilty of worse sins than those they were accusing him of committing. Now think about that. He goes through this list. They've accused him of several bad things. You know, talking about blasphemy. You're talking about doing away with the temple, doing away with Moses. And Stephen comes along and says, hey, look, you want to talk about sin? Let's go back and look at your ancestors. Let's go back and look at Hebrew history. Then he went on to say these sins included a misunderstanding of their spiritual roots, verses 1 through 8. They rejected the divinely sent deliverer, verses 9 to 36. They were disobedient to the law, verses 37 to 43. They despised the temple, verses 44 to 50. And then they rejected God and the truth, verses 51 through 53. So, as I said, you tell them what you're going to tell them, you tell them, and then you tell them again. So that's kind of where we are. So let's go back, and since we at least read this information, and we've got a break, as I said, for the next couple weeks, let's start with verse 2 and read down through verse 8. And here we're going to have, as you look at these verses, some information about the promise to Abraham.
Brad,
yeah.
Before you get into that, could we back up to verse 15 again of chapter 6?
Sure.
Something there that I'm kind of curious. I don't know how other translations read, but it says it saw his face as it had been the face of an angel. That doesn't seem like the right tense for the situation. It would seem to me like it should have said his face as it were the face of an angel.
Yeah. It's a little difficult, Stan, to know exactly if we're talking about timing, when that happened. I know that that's been discussed in multiple sources to figure out, as he comes before the Sanhedrin, does the face look like that then? Is he making his defense? And then it looks like that at that time. It's a curious statement. I don't know that I've got any extra information as far as exactly it took place at this particular point in time. All right, let's, as I said, start with verse 2 and let's go down through verse 8. And he said, Brethren and fathers, hearken. The God of glory appeared unto our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia, before he dwelt in Haran, and said unto him, Get thee out of thy land and from thy kindred, and come into the land which I will show thee. Then came he out of the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Haran. And from thence, when his father was dead, God removed him into this land wherein ye now dwell, and gave him none inheritance in it, no, not so much as to set his foot on. And he promised that he would give it to him in possession and to his seed after him, when as yet he had no child. And God spake on this wise, that his seed should sojourn in a strange land, and that they should bring them into bondage and treat them ill 400 years. And the nation to which they shall be in bondage will I judge, said God. And after that shall they come forth and serve me in this place. And he gave him the covenant of circumcision, so that Abraham begat Isaac and circumcised him the eighth day, and Isaac begat Jacob, and Jacob the 12 patriarchs. So you can see how quickly he begins to move through that. All right, then as you have in verses 9 through 16, you turn over to Joseph and the sojourn, the time that he had. And the patriarchs moved with jealousy against Joseph, sold him into Egypt. And God was with him, and delivered him out of all his afflictions, and gave him favor and wisdom before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And he made him governor over Egypt and all his house. Now there came a famine over all Egypt and Canaan, and great affliction, and our fathers found no sustenance. But when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent forth our fathers the first time. And at the second time Joseph was made known to his brethren. And Joseph's race became manifest unto Pharaoh. And Joseph sent and called to him Jacob, his father, and all his kindred, 75 souls. And Jacob went down into Egypt, and he said, himself and our fathers. And they were carried over unto Shechem, and laid in a tomb that Abraham bought for a price of silver of the sons of Hamor in Shechem. Now, we're going to come back to that little detail in a bit, but I'm going to continue to read. Let's move down to verse 17 and go down through verse 43. Here you have the deliverance of Moses. Moses' deliverance of the Hebrews, starting with verse 17. But at the time of the promise, when that drew nigh, God vouched unto Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt, till there arose another king over Egypt who knew not Joseph. The same dealt craftily with our race, and ill-treated our fathers, that they should cast out their babes to the end they might not live. At which season Moses was born and was exceedingly fair, and was nourished 3 months in his father's house. And when he was cast out, Pharaoh's daughter took him up, and nourished him for her own son. And Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. Now that little detail, by chance, is not mentioned in the Old Testament as far as instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. And he was mighty in his words and works. But when he was well nigh 40 years old, it came unto his heart to visit his brethren and the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him and avenged him that was oppressed, smiting the Egyptian. And he supposed that his brethren understood that God by his hand was giving them deliverance, but they understood not. And the day following he appeared unto them as they strove, and would have set them at one again, saying, Sirs, ye are brethren, why do ye wrong one another? But he that did the neighbor wrong thrust him away, saying, Who made thee a ruler and judge over us? Wouldest thou kill me as thou killed the Egyptian yesterday? And Moses fled at this saying, and became a sojourner in the land of Midian, where he begat 2 sons. And when he was 40 years old, and when 40 years old were fulfilled, and when 40 years were fulfilled, an angel appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai, in a flame of fire in a bush. And when Moses saw it, he wondered at the sight. And as he drew near, behold, there came a voice of the Lord, I am the God of thy fathers, the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses trembled, and durst not behold. And the Lord said unto him, Loose the shoes from thy feet, from the place wherein thou standest is holy ground. I have surely seen the affliction of my people that is in Egypt, and have heard their groaning, and I am come down to deliver them. And now come, I will send thee into Egypt. Thus Moses, whom they refused, saying, or this Moses, whom they refused, saying, Who made thee a ruler and judge? Him hath God sent to be both a ruler and a deliverer with the hand of the angel that appeared to him in the bush. This man led them forth, having wrought wonders and signs in Egypt, and in the Red Sea, and in the wilderness 40 years. This is that Moses, who said unto the children of Israel, A prophet shall God raise up unto you from among your brethren, like unto me. This is he that was in the church in the wilderness with the angel that spake to him in the Mount Sinai, and with our fathers, who received living oracles to give unto us, to whom our fathers would not be obedient, but thrust him from them and turned back in their hearts unto Egypt, saying unto Aaron, Make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, who led us forth out of the land of Egypt, we know not what has become of him. And they made a calf in these days, and brought a sacrifice unto the idol, and rejoiced in the works of their hands. But God turned and gave them up to serve the host of heaven, as it is written in the book of the prophets, Did ye offer unto me slain beasts and sacrifices 40 years in the wilderness, O house of Israel? And he took up the tabernacle of Moloch, and the star of the god of Rephim, the figures which ye made to worship him. And I will carry you away unto Babylon. Now, this is very unpleasant history. It's kind of like the stuff that if you've got some black sheep in the family, when the family reunion comes up, you know, you just sort of don't want to talk about that. But he brings up all of these bad issues. Then in 44 through 46, you have the building of the tabernacle and the time of Joshua. So down there in 44, starting there, our fathers had the tabernacle of the testimony in the wilderness, even as he appointed, who spake unto Moses, that he should make it according to the figure that he had seen, which also our fathers in their turn brought in with Joshua when they entered on the possession of the nations, that God thrust out before the face of our fathers under the days of David, who found favor in the sight of God and asked to find a habitation for the God of Jacob. But Solomon built him a house. And then, let's see, we have, moving down a little bit more, I think I read a little bit too much, 47 through 50, you've got there the information about the reigns of David and Solomon. So, picking up, let's just start with 46, who found favor in the sight of God, asked to find a habitation for God, for the God of Jacob. But Solomon built him a house, howbeit the Most High dwelleth not in houses made with hands, as saith the prophet, the heaven is my throne, and the earth the footstool of my feet. What manner of house will ye build me, saith the Lord? Or what is the place of my rest? Did not my hand make all these things? And then he gets into your stiff-necked people, and that, of course, does not go very well. All right, turning back to some of the things that we looked at, let's make a practical point or two. And I'm not going to go through all this. You can find a lot of information online where I can get you the information if you want as well. But as people go through Acts chapter 7, and many have, you've got a lot of historical details. As I said, it's a nice way to sum up a lot of Old Testament history. But if you like to check things out and you say, well, does this agree with this? You will find that in Acts chapter 7, there are some places, multiple places, probably six or eight, where skeptics go back to and they say, aha, we have found a Bible contradiction. Here is where Scripture conflicts. And if you, I could say, do any looking online and you're looking for something like Bible contradictions, likely one of the places that you will find will be Acts chapter 7. This is almost the gold mine for skeptics. And as you look at that, and you can go back and, for example, look at the places where Abraham and Jacob, where they bought land and where they were buried. This is not exactly a complete parallel, but I'll give you an example. You remember the information about Jesus baptizing people? How many people did Jesus baptize? Zero. But you do have a statement in the New Testament which talks about the Lord baptizing. So somebody will say, well, look, over here it says Jesus baptized. Over here it says the Lord didn't baptize any. So that's a contradiction. No. Anybody remember how those two things go together? Yes. Jesus baptized through or by his disciples. For example, if we have a need, and somebody says, did you go to the store and get bread? You might say yes. Now, if you say yes, the person might assume what? That you were the one who went to the store and got bread. But if your husband picked it up, would you be lying if you said that has been accomplished through someone else? So sometimes we get very literal with language and we have a certain expectation. And when you, like I say, start looking at how things go together, you have reasonable explanations. We may not know exactly how the details went because a person says we have three or four different explanations. Here's something that happened to me the other day. Not far from Palmer's, I was coming back. And I was getting ready to turn, and there was a police officer, a sheriff's deputy, that passed me and about three other cars. And I noticed in the rearview mirror that after he got past me and the other three or four cars, he hit the lights. And then he turned into somebody's driveway, and I assumed that he turned around. Now, why did he turn around and why did he hit the lights? I don't know. Maybe he got a call. Maybe there was something from me. I don't think so. Or maybe there was something from the other two cars that were behind me that he saw he didn't like and he was going to come around. Now, after he hit the lights, I don't know where he went. I would assume that because he turned into that driveway that he wasn't headed there, it looked like he was going to turn around. But down there in the area of Palmer's, you can head off in several different directions. And if you're the police officer and you've had to go down a little ways to find a turnaround spot, which way did he go? And if he were the fellow who were chasing somebody, you again have to make the decision, which way am I going to go to chase that guy? You know, it could be here, it could be here, could be here. I have really no direction, you know, as far as 100% certainty. And that's a little bit like when you have somebody come along and they say, you know, put these two things together. I may not know exactly which direction to go. I can say it could have been this way, it could have been this way, it could have been this way, it could have been this way. All four of those or all five of those are perfectly reasonable possibilities. just like saying the police officer could have gone in these four or five directions. And just because I don't necessarily know which of the four or five would be correct, that doesn't mean that there is a contradiction. And when you look at Acts chapter 7, that's what you find. There are reasonable explanations as far as the items that skeptics bring up and say, okay, here's a possibility. I can't say for sure that this is the right way. And here's another option. This could have been the way it was. But I can lay out at least one and likely four or five different alternatives. And yet, if you do that, almost without exception, after you've gone through all that and said, look, these are all possibilities, can't say for sure which one it is, but these are all reasonable, these are all possible, these are all items which help explain what you're saying is a contradiction, 99 times out of 100, what are you going to hear? You think it's going to satisfy the person? No. Does that surprise you that that's not going to satisfy the person? No. Because even with Jesus' miracles, you're the Son of God? You're a prophet? Prove it by signs. Well, I've raised the dead, I've healed the blind, I've cured the lame, I've done all those things. Are they satisfied? No. They're still not going to believe. So when you have circumstances like that where somebody comes along and they say, well, I've got a Bible contradiction for you. Okay, we've researched that. We have some options for you to consider. Nope, I still disbelieve. Don't feel bad. Don't feel upset. If people were not willing to be convinced by Jesus' miracles, by the apostles' miracles, by the inspired teaching of men like Stephen here in Acts chapter 6 and Acts chapter 7, we're also not going to fare well with some people sometimes. That's just the way that people are. You don't have a good and honest heart. So the problem is not with you, the problem is with them. Anything you want to add or ask? Right?
Time, several years ago, there was an article in a newspaper up in Northern Idaho. This politician, when he was younger, he was working on road crew and he said, we built all this on the highway, and somebody wrote in, he put that in the newspaper, somebody wrote it, he didn't do any of that, we did that. He, through his political and his knowledge of what was going on, he had set it up to be done, so it's exactly what you're saying. Somebody else actually went out there and done it. And if you think about it, somebody else might have done the whole besides that person that wrote in. But he put the trees or whatever was in the ground.
Yeah.
The exact same thing.
Yeah, we talk about it with our kids sometimes. You know, we do it or we see the kids do it when really we were the ones who were responsible. You know, my child bought a new bicycle. Well, really?
Yeah,
where do you get the money? I mean, it was mom or it was dad that fronted the money for that. So, as I say, if you want to get really literal, we could say a lot of things in lies. A lot of things in life are lies when that's really not true. But you have to sometimes recognize that we do use words in an accommodative sense. And sometimes there are ways in which we say that this was done through another. Politicians do the same thing. You know, look at the jobs I brought into the state. Really? There were no other senators voting on the bill? Nobody else in Congress funded that? So yes, happens a lot of times. Anybody else? All right, let's take a look at what we find in Acts chapter 7 and verse 2. We've read through Acts chapter 7 and kind of gotten a highlight. And he said, brethren and fathers, hearken. The God of glory appeared unto our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he dwelt in Haran. Let's go back and think about things. Remember back there in Acts chapter 6 and verse 14, what was Stephen charged with? Hey, you're the guy who's doing what? Trying to change things, right? Moses gave us this law and we've got the temple. And now Stephen goes back and he's, as you see, as we read from Acts chapter 7, what's he making the point about God? Did God change some things as you look at Old Testament history? There were a lot of changes. You know, you've got a covenant with Abraham, and then things come along, and what happens? Abraham's family expands. Things change a little bit there. Things change a little bit more when they get into Egyptian bondage. Things change a little bit more when they get out of Egyptian bondage. They're out there wandering in the wilderness for a while, and then things change a little bit. They go into the land of Canaan, and then they finally get a king. The Old Testament has a lot of changes, but all of those changes were designed to lead to something, right? What were they designed to bring about? The Messiah, Christ. So God, he had this big plan, and it was going to result in a lot of different things throughout time, and now that's what Stephen is trying to bring forth. So as you look at Acts chapter 7 and verse 1, what was the question that was posed by the high priest? He said, are these things so? What's that another way of asking? He says, are you
doing what's charged?
Well, maybe. What's the question that you answer before the judge if it's a criminal trial? Are you
guilty?
Are you guilty or are you not guilty? And that's what the high priest is asking Stephen. Are you guilty or are you not guilty? And what's Stephen's response? Rather than say, I'm guilty or I'm not guilty, what's he do? He just goes right through the middle and says, let's have a history lesson, guys. And that's precisely what he did. So he presents that third possibility. He says, he affirms that God brought about a new religious system, and that was heaven's plan before the world was created. Let's take a look at that seventh chapter again, see what we have down there in verse 37. This is that Moses, who said unto the children of Israel, a prophet shall God raise up unto you from among your brethren, like unto me. He just kind of slips that right in the middle of his discussion. And that's what he is now affirming. Now, if you take a look at all the verses that we read, if you are a Jew and you reject Jesus, this is sort of reading between the lines a little bit with Stephen's argument, but if you are a Jew and you reject Jesus, bearing in mind what we just looked at, Acts chapter 7, verse 37, there's going to come someone who's a prophet like unto me. Moses said, this is God's plan. Somewhere down the line, this guy is going to show up. He's going to be similar to me. So if you reject your Messiah, Christ, ultimately you're also rejecting what? All your past. All your history. The history that you claim to love. The history that you hold up and you say, the Gentiles don't have this. This is our background. Are you going to throw it all away? You have to. Because Jesus is the one that this history was pointing to. Now when you begin to piece it together like that, and then you throw in what he says he sees as far as Jesus ascended, can you understand why they wanted to kill him and did kill him? I mean, this presentation plus what he claims as far as seeing Christ, it was enough to really drive these people over the edge. And it must have really shocked the people who heard it. This also, I think, begins to help explain why you see a lot of conversions in the book of Acts. If you were a Jew, and you begin to hear preaching that all the Jewish history that you are familiar with, you know, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Solomon, David, Saul, the judges, all of this stuff has been leading up to this point. If you're willing to listen long enough to hear that kind of preaching, what do you go home and think? That's the most amazing sermon. That's the most amazing presentation I've ever heard. I can't believe that what all human history was pointing to as far as the Jewish people has now come to pass. Well, as you look at the bold proclamation by Stephen, you have, I think, some helpful information to us. For example, in our day and time, this is especially prevalent right now. If people feel like they're not being treated well, what role do they play? We're the victim, right? We see it played out all the time. But as you start to look at the first Christians, do you see people who played the victim card? I don't. You don't see that in the book of Acts. You don't see that anywhere else in the New Testament. But in our day and time, if you feel that you're the victim, what do you do? What are people engaging in right now? All right. Resist, rebel. What else? Protests, email campaigns, get on TV, write the congressman, picket, all those kinds of things. But rather than complain, you remember what Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 3? We are people who have a living hope. Remember that verse? We have a living hope. And then as you start to look at some other goods, some other passages, you begin to find what they were willing to do when it came to worldly goods. Acts 8:4. They're willing to leave their homes. There's this persecution. And they're willing to leave the place where they have perhaps spent several years. They're willing to leave behind their worldly possessions. They're willing to go to other places because the gospel of Christ is what matters most to them. They're willing to be martyrs. You have Christians sometimes headed into a prison cell. They're willing to do that as well. And then back there in Acts chapter 5 and verse 41, you recall that verse 2, they rejoiced that they were counted worthy to suffer dishonor for the name, for the cause of Christ. When the Christians were mistreated, the church did not stop assembling. They did not stop praying, as we see in Acts chapter 4, verses 23 and 24. We recall surely Peter's admonition in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. Be always ready to give an answer for the hope, that living hope that is within you. And then we remember, too, Revelation 2:10, John urged faithfulness, even if that requires our life. So the Christians, as they are persecuted, rather than run and hide, what do they say? We're going to stand up. And if you're going to fight us, what are we going to do? We're going to fight back, not with sticks and stones and guns and clubs, but we're going to fight back by teaching the gospel of Christ. The harder you come, the harder we're going to push back with the gospel of Christ. You think there's a message in there for us today? When we have people who say homosexuality is what you need to believe in, you know, we need to be willing, we need to be bold enough to stand up and say that's not God's plan. Or they come at us with all the other things. And the world doesn't have it right. Anybody see the story that just broke about marijuana and sperm count? Yes, I saw that this morning, but they were talking about women, chance of pregnancy is less, and sperm get lazy. They just kind of swim around aimlessly instead of, you know, heading in the right direction. So I thought, you know, the world is over here saying marijuana is good and doesn't cause any problems, but, you know, God's plan is always the best. It's always the right one. Anything that went at or ask? Yes, sir. John 7, Jesus said, judge righteous judgment. So judging righteously has never been wrong, and that's the right thing to do. And it's interesting, it's kind of like the people who holler about tolerance. You're telling me not to judge? What have you just done? You've made a judgment. So you're hypocritical about that. But the world has its ideas and views, but if they're really tested, they don't stand up very well. You're right. Exactly right. Anybody else? Well, we are not at a good stopping point. We've got about 4 minutes left. So I think what I'm going to do, let's go back to Acts 7, and let's take a look at some verses that we didn't look at. Let's read the final verses in Acts chapter 7 to set the stage for next class. Stephen, we've kind of talked about what he was trying to do, and then as you start with verse 51, you begin to see he comes down to the point where he really gets tough on these people. He said, ye stiff-necked, and uncircumcised in heart and ears. Ye do always resist the Holy Spirit, as your fathers did, so do ye. Which of you, which of the prophets did not your fathers persecute? And they killed them that showed before the coming of the righteous one, of whom ye have now become betrayers and murderers. Ye who received the law, as it was ordained by angels, and kept it not. Now when they heard these things, they were cut to the heart, and they gnashed on him with their teeth. That's not a surprise, based on what we studied today. But he, being full of the Holy Spirit, looked up steadfastly into heaven and saw the glory of God, and Jesus standing on the right hand of God, and said, behold, I see the heavens open, and the Son of Man standing on the right hand of God. But they cried out with a loud voice, and stopped their ears, and rushed upon him with one accord. And they cast him out of the city, and stoned him, and the witnesses laid down their garments at the feet of a young man named Saul. And they stoned Stephen, calling upon the Lord, and saying, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit. And he kneeled down and cried with a loud voice, Lord, lay not this sin to their charge. And when he had said this, he fell asleep. Once again, as I read those final words, it seems to me that you have some strong parallels between that and what's taking place in modern society. When you start looking at some of the college campuses, Berkeley would be one example, and you have people out there who are hollering and screaming, you have a virtual mob. Can you do anything in that kind of environment? No. I mean, people have today stopped up their ears, just like people back in the time of Acts chapter 7. They will not listen. And if that's the kind of culture that you're dealing with, even if it is an individual, we've all dealt with somebody like that, they simply will not listen. Regardless of who is talking, regardless of what kind of evidence is set forth, they will not listen. Didn't Jesus deal with that in the Sermon on the Mount? He said, cast not your pearls before swine. And you find Stephen, I don't think he was doing that. The Sanhedrin certainly needed to hear what he had to say, and they were given an excellent gospel sermon, but it was, at the end, something that they didn't want to hear, so they took his life.